We are in a second week of a five-week series called Life in Babylon. And we are asking the question, how do you live in Babylon? But maybe one of the first questions you have to ask is, what is Babylon? You're like, okay, what are you talking about here? And so Babylon, there's three answers here. First of all, Babylon was a 6th century B.C. empire in what we call modern-day Iraq. It was the dominant empire of its day in the 6th century. It kind of dominated almost all of the Middle East and really beyond. And so it was this huge, powerful, but largely godless place. And it's a place where the Jews were taken in exile to live because they had overtaken Israel. Secondly, another definition for the scriptures would be the scriptures sometimes refer to Rome and its empire in the kind of the first through the fifth century, that Rome was kind of Babylon, a godless place, dominating people, hurting and abusing people. It was kind of a present-day Babylon in its day. Then in Revelation, you're going to see that really it's referred to Babylon again as any world system that rejects the beauty of God's design and his guiding hand, and as well as rejecting his authority. It's referred to as Babylon. And so we think, how do you live in Babylon? And we have a tendency, as Jonathan spoke about last week, that when we live in kind of Babylon, what do people have a tendency to do? And on one hand, on the left over here, we have a tendency to buy into the culture. When you live in Babylon, you want to do as the Babylonians do because you don't want to stand out and be kind of picked on for that. And so you have a tendency to buy into the culture. Or on the other side, people have a tendency to become what I call a separatist or an isolationist, to become hyperly religious and kind of just buy into this religious thing and just be as religious as they can be and lose touch with the culture and be totally separate from it and separatist. And I don't think that either one of those are very good answers. Now, let's go back and put it in context. Jonathan did this last week. Let's put it historically so you understand what's going on. This is kind of a chronology of the Old Testament from Abraham to the end of the Old Testament. Now, before Abraham, there's Noah and all those dudes from before, right? There's a lot of history before that. But God comes to Abraham and says, Abraham, I want to make a great nation out of you. I want your descendants to be more than the number of the sand on the beach. Like, I'm going to do incredible things. And Abraham goes, okay, I'll obey. And he starts following God. And then all of this history unfolds, which I love this stuff. But we don't have time tomorrow to go through all of this. But we come to this time where the kingdoms of Israel is divided. There's a lot of anarchy. There's a lot of division. They have a civil war. The northern tribes, the 10, are defeated by Assyria in 722 BC. They are scattered to the winds in what we call the lost 10 tribes of Israel. And then the last two tribes, we call them Judah because they had absorbed Benjamin into their kind of tribe. And so the tribe of Judah, because that's why we call them Jews, is because they come from the tribe of Judah. So it's not just Israel. Now, they're still out there somewhere, and God's going to gather them back someday. But right now, they're being exiled as Jews. So this is the time of exile. Eventually, they come back to rebuild, never to the point where they had been before. But now let's expand this a little bit. Here's the time of exile. And what we're going to do in the next 5 weeks is we're going to ask the question, how do you live in Babylon? How do you survive it? And we're going to touch on it with some different individuals. We're going to start today with Daniel. Daniel in 607, 605, somewhere in there, 20 years before the official end of the southern tribes, Babylon comes in and they take the brightest and the best and they take them back to Babylon. We're going to talk about Daniel today. Next week, we're going to talk about Jeremiah. How did Jeremiah survive this? What did he have to offer? The following week, we're going to talk about Ezra and Nehemiah because that's kind of at the tail end of the exile. And so how did God use him and how did he survive all of that? Because he was serving at the top levels of the government in Babylon at that point. And then we're going to talk about a woman named Esther, this incredible lady that God used during the rebuilding time remaining in Babylon. And then the last week, we're going to talk about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They kind of come in the middle of all that. Growing up, I never knew their Hebrew names. These are their Aramaic names. I always knew him as my shack, your shack, and a bungalow. But but that's not probably what we should call him. I'm going to be embarrassed in heaven someday. I'm going to go, hey, bungalow, what's happening, man? But whatever. We're going to talk about these guys, okay? And how they handled living in Babylon. So here's the question. How did they navigate living in Babylon? How did they do it? What did that look like? What did they do? It really begs the question then for us to answer is how can we navigate living in a post-Christian culture that's going through such profound and radical change? How can we navigate a culture that has changed kind of almost as a tsunami, an avalanche, it feels like, in the last several years? But actually, this has been coming for a long time. All the seeds have been sown, and it has influenced our culture along the way, and it just kind of came to fruition in the last several years. So here's just a thought you might be able to go home with. There are four things that they rediscovered living in Babylon. The Jews rediscovered five things. I have four right here. First of all, they rediscovered God's truth, God's word. You know, they had almost totally lost it. In fact, they couldn't even find the scrolls anymore. That's how far they'd gotten away from God. They weren't even going to his word. They didn't even know where the scrolls were anymore. They rediscovered God's word. Secondly, they rediscovered God's mission, his purpose. They began to have it clarified. That's what happens when you get isolated, when you become an exile, when life becomes hard, you rediscover God's mission. Third, they rediscovered God's heart as redemption. It was all new to them again. It's really powerful. And interestingly enough, the fourth thing is they rediscovered God's design for family. How important it was. They'd lost track of that. I think in the long run, what they really rediscovered was God himself. In exile, they rediscovered who God was. You know, in 1983, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, in his acceptance speech of the Templeton Award, it's an award for those who contribute greatly to the political and religious life of the world, and he's this Russian dissident who had spent a lot of time in the gulags in prison in northern Russia. When he got out and when he came to the West, he received this prize, and in his acceptance speech, he said this: men have forgotten God, and that is why all this happened in Russia. Interestingly enough, I think you take from that, when you forget who God is, you actually forget who mankind is. When you forget who God is, you forget who man is. Look at this quote. You can disregard and defy creation. You cannot, I'm sorry, disregard and defy creation without cost and consequence to the creature, to the creation. Because human beings were created in the image of God. And when we reject him, when we reject his image, we begin to reject each other and what that means to be made in his image. I think this describes the culture in which we live. Now, today I want to talk about Daniel. Daniel, in his Hebrew, his name means God is my judge. And if we were to kind of secularize that or maybe bring that up to modern day, here's what it would mean. It would mean I live for an audience of one. That's who Daniel was. He goes, I live for no one else. I live for the audience of one, and that be my God. That's who I'm going to live my life for. God is my judge. I receive that. I accept that. I buy that. I'm into it. And he is the one that I live for. That's what Daniel is all about. And we're going to see now how he lives that out. Now, you guys, Daniel's an incredible figure. He's an amazing guy. And there's all sorts of things that he did. Things that we go, wow, he was interpreting dreams. He was doing all sorts of amazing things. But when I look at his life and I try to boil it down to one word, it's where we're going to camp today. One word. I find the word integrity. Daniel lived, found integrity. Here's what integrity means. It means the quality of being honest and having strong moral principles. There's all sorts of synonyms that you could use for it. The second definition is this: the state of being whole or undivided. The word integrity really comes from a Latin word, integra, which means this. It means to be intact, integer. It's really the word from which we get integration, or the word intact. And what I think is going on here is it's actually, he's so intact, both with God and with man. He is connected. He is in sync with who God is and who man is. He's a man of incredible integrity. I love that. Now, you guys, he's an incredible guy. Look in the very beginning of the book of Daniel, look at this. It says, in the third year, the reign of Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and he besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand and some of the vessels of the house of God. All the things that they used for worship in the temple, he took them. Took them back to Babylon. All the gold, all the silver, all the incredible things. Some would even suggest maybe the Ark of the Covenant. We don't know for sure where it's at today. I personally think it's buried somewhere beneath the rock, the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem still, but I don't know. No one's found it. And it says that he took them back, and he placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. And then the king, commander, Asphanet, his chief eunuch, not a great thing to be, to bring some of the people of Israel, both the royal family and of the nobility, verse 4, use without blemish, of good appearance, meaning handsome dudes. You're going to take, we'll use without blemish, handsome dudes, and is skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace. He says, take all them. Take the best and the brightest, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. And the king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and the wine that he drank. And they were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. And among them were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. That's Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Meshach, Meshach, and Abednego. That's who his buddies were, right? Okay, so Daniel's one of them. You guys, he's probably only 15 years old. They probably castrated him too. They made him a eunuch because they didn't want to face the troubles that might have come with that. Can you imagine? And then he says, okay, bring him in and feed him my food and give him my wine. Look at this. It's an amazing thing. You know, he's so amazing. Daniel is. Look in Ezekiel chapter 14. Ezekiel is prophesying against Israel, against the Jews, against Judah. And he says this, and the word of the Lord came to me, son of man, when the land sins against me by acting faithlessly, and I stretch out my hand against it and break its supply of bread and send famine upon it and cut it off from man and beast, even if these three men, Noah, and the righteous, one of the most righteous men ever, Daniel, circle it, and even Job, if we were to take those three and put them together and put them into where what's happening, he says they would not deliver but their own lives for their righteousness, declares the Lord. Even those three guys couldn't save this culture. Wow. But Daniel, he said, even him, one of the most righteous men that ever lived, he wouldn't have been able to help him. It's amazing. Now, you guys, I just want to touch on several instances of integrity in his life, like where he demonstrated it. And Daniel's 12 chapters long. I'm only going to touch on the first 6 chapters, really only 5 of them, maybe less, depending on time. But it doesn't really matter. We want to look at instances of his life where he demonstrated tremendous integrity. So let's go to verse 8 of chapter 1. It says, but Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself. You see, he was being offered everything that Babylon had to offer. And he said, I'm not going to do it. I am not going to defile myself. He determined that from the very beginning. It's probably really a critical thing for us to learn. You have to evaluate from the very beginning, what are you going to do with your life? Where are you going to serve? What are you going to commit to? Middle of the temptation, it's too late. He decided before that, I am not going to defile myself. So look at this. He resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore, he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. This is kind of a dangerous thing to do, just so you know. He's like, hey, I'm not going to do that, guys, you know, just so you know. And they're like, hey, what do you mean? So here's what he does. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion, in the sight of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord, the king, who assigned your food and your drink, for why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who were of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. So then if you don't eat this stuff and you start looking thin, beleaguered, you know, kind of not very in shape, he's going to kill me. And Daniel says, I know. And then Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servant for 10 days. Let it be given vegetables to eat, water to drink. And let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you. Compare us after 10 days. I challenge you. Let it happen. 10 days isn't going to kill anybody, but just evaluate. Look at us next to each other. And deal with your servants according to what you see. Wow, okay. And so he did that. And look at this next slide. So he listened to them in this matter and tested them for 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, it was seen that they were in better appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. Wow. So look what happens. This is fabulous. This is incredible. So the steward took away their food, all the fatty foods of the king and the wine, and they the wine that they were to drink, and he gave them vegetables. Now, I'm not saying let's be vegetarians. I like a nice steak periodically. But he says, man, they had chosen to trust God, not defile themselves. Now look in verse 17. And as for the four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. In the end of the time, when the king had commanded that they should be brought to the chief of the eunuchs, brought them before Nebuchadnezzar after their 3 years of training. And he says, they brought him before Nebuchadnezzar, and the king spoke with them, and among all of them, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And therefore they stood before the king, and in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters that were in all of his kingdom. And Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus. He refused to be defiled by the culture of Babylon. And God blessed them and used them and made them wiser, more insightful, more discerning than all the rest. Because Daniel decided, I'm not going to do this broken culture. Wow. It's powerful. Now, you guys, there was probably pressure along the way, right? Of course there was. But he was a man of integrity from the time of being a 15-year-old kid. Wow. You guys, there's another instance in chapter 2 of integrity. And it's a time when Nebuchadnezzar needed a dream to be, the king needed a dream to be interpreted. And in fact, in this situation, he says, I've had a dream, and he brought all of his wise men, the magi is where we get that word from. He brings them all together and he says, hey, you guys, I want you to tell, not only to interpret my dream, I want you to tell me And people are like, are you kidding? This is crazy. And look in verse 10. It says, the Chaldeans answered the king and said, there is not a man on earth who could meet the king's demand. For no great and powerful king has asked for such a thing of any magician, an enchanter, or Chaldean. No one's ever done this before, king. That seems a little risky to say, really? Are you out of your mind? You're asking for something no one's ever asked for and nothing anybody could ever do. Now look at this. The thing that the king asked for is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods. Little do they know what they're talking about, whose dwelling is not with flesh. Look at verse 12. Because of this, the king was angry and very furious and commanded that all the men, the wise men of Babylon, be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions, and they were going to kill them all. Daniel and his friends included. And then Daniel, highlight this, replied with prudence and discretion. You might want to do that if you're facing death. You might want to say, let me bring a little bit of wisdom, a little bit of balance to the situation here. And so he replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. And he declared to Arioch, the king's captain, why is this decree of the king so urgent? Why do this so quickly? I love that. Now, and then look at God. Then Arioch made the matter known to Daniel, and Daniel went in, because Daniel said, hey, let me deal with this. I can do this. God can do this. Look at this in verse 16. And Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. Then look at this. This is really important. Then Daniel went to his house, and he made the matter known to his buddies, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions. And he told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery. He said, hey, guys, we need to pray. We need to pray. I believe that God can do this. And I put my neck on the line. So let's pray. And he told them to seek mercy from God, God of heaven, concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. And then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Because not only did he save his own skin, and not only did he save the skin of his other Jewish companions, but of all the Chaldeans that were with him. He saved all of them. Wow. He didn't just look out for his own. He looked out for everybody. I love that. Look at this in verse 26. The king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation? And Daniel answered the king and said, no wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. Can you imagine the boldness to say, hey, no one can do this, but there's a God in heaven. It's not the one you know, Nebuchadnezzar. It's not the one you worship. It's the one who I know. And he can reveal mysteries. Wow. Your dream and your visions of your head as you lay in bed are these. To you, O king, as you lay in the bed, came thoughts of what would be after this, and he revealed the mysteries made known to you of what is to be. But as for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, and this is really key, not because of any wisdom that I have more than all the living. This isn't me. Do you understand that, Nebuchadnezzar? I don't come here because I'm so slick. I'm so amazing. I'm so above everybody else. It's not because of any wisdom that I have that's better than the rest, but look at this. But in order that the interpretation may be known to the king, that you may know the thoughts of your mind, that God has revealed this to me. It was bold. It was amazing. You guys, in the midst of all this, Daniel said this. Listen to his heart. Daniel blessed the God of heaven, and Daniel said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He moves kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise. For you have given me wisdom and might, and have made known to me what we asked of you. For you have made known to us the king's matter. You guys, wouldn't that be an incredible prayer for each of us to pray? That we would say, God, you're in charge. You know everything that's in the darkness, and you are light yourself. You give wisdom, discernment, direction to each of us. This is a prayer we might be able to really buy into for our own lives in the midst of a crazy world, that we might pray this along with Daniel from years ago. You guys, there's another instance of integrity, I think, that happened in chapter 4. You can see we're skipping chapter 3. That's going to be my shack, your shack, and the bungalows, okay? That's going to be theirs. But chapter 4, this is interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream. There's this dream, there's this enormous tree that reached to the heavens, and it says that there's a watcher or someone that came down from heaven and commanded the tree to be chopped down, right down to the stump. And that the stump would then have these bands put around it. And it's really predicting Nebuchadnezzar's humiliation and his downfall. And he's asked, this time, he asked the enchanters to interpret just the dream. He told them the dream, made it easy this time. And they couldn't interpret it. They had no idea. Look in verse 18, though. It says, this dream I, King Nebuchadnezzar, saw, and you, Belteshazzar, who is Daniel, tell me the interpretation, because of all the wise men of the kingdom are not able to make it known to me, the interpretation. But you are able, for the spirit of the holy gods is in you. Wow. And Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was dismayed for a while, and his thoughts alarmed him. Now, you guys, this is the most negative comment about Daniel that I can find, that he was dismayed for a while. I'll tell you what, he's a pretty slick dude. You know, I mean, this is the most negative thing that I can find about him. And his thoughts were alarmed. And the king answered and said, Belteshazzar, let not the dream of the interpretation alarm you. I mean, Nebuchadnezzar's feeling bad, right? Like, Daniel, I didn't want to upset you. Bummer, you know, like, don't let it bug you. It's okay. And Daniel goes, no, it's not going to be okay, just so you know. But he says this, my Lord, may the dream be for those who hate you and its interpretation for your enemies. I wish this was going to be an interpretation against all your enemies. Well, look at verse 26. He says part of the interpretation. And as it was commanded to leave the stump of the root of the tree, your kingdom, Nebuchadnezzar, shall be confirmed for you from the time that you know the heaven rules. Therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Because this is about your destruction, Nebuchadnezzar. Going to cut it all the way down. In fact, he says you're going to live among the grass on the ground that's full of dew, and you're going to go crazy, and you're going to eat grass like an animal for 7 years. You're going to be humiliated. And here he says, therefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable to you. Break off your sins by practicing righteousness, and your iniquities by showing mercy to the oppressed, that there may perhaps be a lengthening of your prosperity. He gave him warning. He says, this whole interpretation is about your destruction and humiliation. But repent. Change your heart. Change your mind. Head a new direction. This is going to be a disaster. But sure enough, it happened. It happened just like he said. Look at this in verse 34. And at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, it looks like even Nebuchadnezzar helped him write this section of the book. It's amazing. Lifted my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him for who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. Does it start to sound a lot like the prayer that Daniel had earlier? Here, Nebuchadnezzar has learned more about the holiness and the awesomeness of God, and he is praying this. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. And he does according to his will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay his hand or to say to him, what have you done? You can't question God. Nebuchadnezzar figured it out. You can't question it. At the same time, my reason returned to me, and for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and splendor returned to me. My counselors and my lord sought me, and I was established in my kingdom, and still more greatness was added to me. And now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are right and his ways are just, and those who walk in pride, he is able to humble. He knew it because that's what he experienced. And Daniel had led him to it. At his own risk of life and limb, Daniel was bold with integrity before him. You guys, one more just for this morning. Another instance of integrity that Daniel lived out. So eventually, Belshazzar, who is the son or the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, he's throwing a huge party. I mean, it's a giant party. It is like what you could imagine. And in the midst of the party, as it's going on, and near the end of it, there's a hand that appears and writes on a wall. It'll scare the stew out of you, right? I mean, it's like, whoa! And there's a hand writing on a wall. And they're looking for someone to tell us what's written there. And no one could read it because it was in Hebrew. And so, it says, then Daniel was brought in before the king. And the king answered and said to Daniel, you are Daniel, one of the exiles of Judah. He'd been forgotten. See, the son or the grandson didn't really talk to dad much. Didn't ask him, who's been your best advisors, right? He goes, no, I can do this on my own, thank you. He starts running himself. And he says, now, I hear that you're one of the exiles of Judah, whom the king my father brought from Judah, and I've heard that you, that the spirit of the gods is in you, and that the light and understanding and excellent wisdom is in you. Wow, of course they are. Now the wise men and enchanters have been brought in before me to read the writings and made known to me its interpretation, but they could not show the interpretation on the matter. But I have heard that you can give interpretation and solve the problems. Now if you can read the writing and make known to me the interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and I'll give you a gold chain. This is like a representative of incredible wealth and power. And around your neck, and it shall be the third ruler of the kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar will be going to be number one. I'm going to be number two. You're going to be number three. I'm going to give you all this if you can interpret it. Wow, that's the promise of power, right? Influence. To be admired. To be set up above other people. That's what he's saying. And now look at this. I love this. This is such, so full of integrity. And Daniel answered and said to the king, let your gifts be for yourself. I don't want your money. Keep it. That's not why I'm here. Right? He didn't come here to make money, get power. He said, let your gifts be for yourself and give your rewards to another person. Nevertheless, I will read the writing to the king and make known to him the interpretation. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and greatness and glory and majesty. That's how it all happened. It was because of God's hand. And because of the greatness that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would, he killed. And whom he would, he kept alive. And whom he would, he raised up. And whom he would, he humbled. But then his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened so that he dealt proudly. He was brought down from the kingly throne and his glory was taken from him. He was driven from among the children of mankind and his mind was made like that of a beast. We've already covered that part, right? And his dwelling was with the wild donkeys. And he was fed grass like the ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven until he knew that the Most High God rules the kingdom of mankind and sets over it whom he will. He's saying, my God is in charge. You can play games with him if you want. My God is in charge. Wow. Now look at this, verse 22. And you, his son, Belshazzar, Daniel, or Belshazzar, I mean, the son of this grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, you have not humbled your heart, though you knew all this. You knew it all. You'd seen it. You'd heard about it. But you didn't care. You didn't humble yourself. You lived in pride. And arrogance, doing it your own way. Wow. He says, and you have lifted up yourself against the Lord of heaven and the vessels of his house. So during that party, he brought all those vessels from the temple, and everybody was using them simply to drink and eat and defile the very things of God. He used them during that party. And he says, and the vessels of the house you have brought in before you, and you and your lords, your wives and your concubines, have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold, the bronze and iron and wood and stone, which you do not see or hear or know, but the God in whose hand is your breath, and those are all your ways you have not honored. The God who keeps you alive, you haven't cared. And then from his presence the hand was sent, and the writing was inscribed, and this is the writing that was inscribed, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Parsim. This is the interpretation of the matter. Mene, God has numbered the days of your kingdom and brought it to an end. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and you have been found wanting. Perez or Persim, your kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and the Persians. Now you guys, this is not a positive interpretation. This is not making friends and influencing people. Right? Well, look what happens, though. Then Belshazzar gave the command, and Daniel was clothed with purple, and a chain of gold was put around his neck, and a proclamation was made about him, and he should be made the third ruler of the kingdom. Now, it was all for naught, because look at this next verse. That very night, Belshazzar and the Chaldean king was killed, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. You see, the robe and the chain and the power was all gone that night. And Daniel knew it'll never be satisfied. I'm going to serve my God. Well, you guys, we have one more situation, but I'm going to skip it. Daniel 6, the lion's den. We'll come back to it sometime, okay? But I want to skip forward then and ask the question. How did Daniel navigate living in Babylon? What did he do? Now, obviously, he did spectacular things, interpreted dreams. He stuck his neck out. But I think at the end of the day, the issue is he lived with incredible godly integrity. The intactness, the integration of his relationship with God and his relationship with people. So I really ask the question, how can we navigate living in a post-Christian culture? Because I don't think there's going to be any quick fixes. There's going to be magic pixie dust that we can kind of sprinkle over all of us, and then also somehow the whole world's going to say, oh my gosh. But how can we navigate through all this change and this profound and radical change we're going through? How do we do it? I think what Daniel has communicated, what he's illustrated, is integrity. That we would be intact with our God, intact with each other, intact with the world. Not buying into the culture, but not becoming so hyperly religious. But let's be engaged, and let's live it out. And the challenge for me, because I feel like a far cry from Daniel, about how am I living with integrity? Honesty, upfrontness, a willing to sacrifice, a willing to be bold for my God. You know, it's interesting that in the core values of Quest, we have four core values. We don't say of them a ton, but they're what we really want us to be like. The first one is love. You know, the scriptures say that they will know that you're Christians by your love for one another. This I have called you to love those who hate you. Love has got to be the lead element that defines who we are as a people. And I feel so inadequate to love very well sometimes. I don't know, do you ever feel that? Sometimes I just feel like, wow, I just fall so short. But love is really it. You know, the third one we talk about at Quest here is relevance. We want to be relevant. We want to be relevant to our culture. But we want to be relevant to God first. And to really be relevant to him means to be relevant to the culture. It doesn't mean that you buy into the culture, but that you would be able to understand it and speak to it well. Let's have relevance. The fourth one is patience. I think this is a great value because it says that God was patient, waiting for all to come to repentance. God exercises patience. Isn't that amazing? So we're going to exercise patience because God does his work in your lives at different times and in different ways. No one's a cookie cutter. So we're going to live with patience. It's one of our core values. But our second core value is this. It's integrity. We want to be a church that's full of integrity. We want to handle relationships with integrity. We want to handle money with integrity. We want to handle the God's word with integrity. We want to deal with our relationships in the community with integrity. And I think that this value is something we can all live out in each one of our lives. That we would be like Daniel, living with integrity in a culture that has walked away from God. But we can live with tremendous integrity. I think it will be among other things that we'll learn from Jeremiah and Nehemiah and Esther and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, other qualities, but this quality of integrity that we might live it out. Right? So let me ask you a question. If I have you ponder it just for a minute. Where in your life could you live with greater integrity? Maybe it's at home in your marriage. Maybe it's with your kids. Maybe it's at work. Maybe it's in your community. Maybe it's here at church. Where is it? He says, hey, let's do it a little different. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to take just a minute and to think it through. And maybe go back to Daniel chapter 1 and say, I've decided not to defile myself. I'm not buying into the culture anymore. I'm not buying into my own sin. I want to stand with the Lord. That's where I'm going to live. Where might it be? So you guys, take a minute. Prepare yourself. Think it through. Make some decisions. Father, listen to the hearts, the broken hearts, the determined hearts of your people.